You are listening to the INCJ podcast, conversations about international criminal justice.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of our Just Art series. And today, John is not joining us, so it's just me. And we are continuing our conversation from the last episode. I hope you have listened to that episode where we introduced a really interesting project in Lagos prison in Nigeria, where we invited two Dutch guests, talked about their experience of conducting a project in the prison there, which is called Informal Justice Court. Today, we are really honored and glad to invite their colleague from Nigeria that worked on the project with them to join us and share their experience of taking part in the project, what they did, what was their experience. And it will be more like a roundtable where we have a conversation about it. We hope it's interesting for them as well, because it has been quite a few years since they finished the project. Maybe they can also reflect on what they thought of it since then, and if there's any opportunities or possibilities for future collaborations or new projects. And as you know already, I'm from a background of prison theater in China, so I might jump in as well if I see any interesting comparisons. So let's start with a round of self-introductions. My name is Xiao Ye, and I'm a senior lecturer of criminology from De Montfort University in the UK. And Mile, would you like to go next, please?
Yes. Hello, everybody. I'm Melle Smits. I work as a visual conceptual artist, mainly in the issue of public space. So I'm interested in the topic itself. Where is the public space? Who owns the public space? And where do we use it for? And in my work, I always try to design or create new public spaces for encounter. That's it.
And maybe Joost?
Good afternoon, everybody. Sorry, my name is Joost van Onna. I work as a researcher at the Public Prosecution Service in the Netherlands and at the VU University in Amsterdam, where I do more traditional research. And together with Melle in our foundation, Aardappelschap Foundation, we do more action research, and where we engage in the project like we are talking to you about today.
And let's welcome Fumi.
Hi, everyone. I'm Fumi Ayeni. I'm from Nigeria. I run the Public Interest Law Partnership, which is a public-private partnership aimed at increasing access to justice in the country. And we do that through two intervention strategies. One is that we run a pro bono clearinghouse where we provide free legal services in different areas of law, both civil and criminal areas. We match people with our partner pro bono lawyers and nonprofits. And we have over 300 partners in our network. And then our second intervention strategy is that we run special projects that are all aimed at increasing and amplifying pro bono in the country. So the Informal Justice Court project was one of such special projects that we helped Mela Youst implement in the country.
Thank you. Maybe Fumi, you could start with telling us a bit about your involvement. How did you come about to collaborate with them, and what was your role in the project?
Oh, wow. So it's been, six, 7 years now? I think, if I remember correctly, I was introduced to Mela Youst by someone at organization, a Dutch organization, I believe it was Heal, who got in touch with me that, you know, they've been trying to implement this very interesting project in the country for a while and had been hitting several roadblocks. And, you know, he wondered if I could be of assistance in some way. And then I eventually got to discuss with them. I heard about the project. Sounded very interesting. I thought, oh, wow, that's new. You know, lore intersection with arts is rare. It's something I'd never heard of in Nigeria before. So I got interested. And yeah, so we got to discuss, I think, primarily where I would say was useful to begin with was, you know, when they explained the struggles that they had in trying to implement it, all the several meetings with the prisons and things not moving forward, I was able to then, you know, look and see how can we bring their project into something that's in an already existing structure. Maybe first of all, dial it back a bit, which I know we had to, like, you know, a bit of friction figuring out what can stay, what has to go. When you're bringing something new in, I wouldn't just say a country like Nigeria. I think generally, you know, you have to figure out how to not make it sound so scary, so new to the traditional court structure and the justice system in general. So that was for me. The initial challenge was, okay, this is what the prisons already allow. This is what the government already allows. And I don't know if I mentioned, because we're a public-private partnership, we have a strong relationship with the government because we're actually uniquely founded by the government of Lagos State and were later incorporated as an NGO. So that gives us a room to play with where we can, when we need to, you know, work well with the government stakeholders, hoping that it's a good government of the day. When I say good government, but one that you can work with in that season. And then we could then, you know, try to see how do we sell this as part of PILP's existing legal clinic structures, because we already run legal clinics in the prisons.
Mm-hmm. Legal clinics, that sounds really interesting as well. What can you briefly tell us what it's like so we know, like, your existing relationship with a prison?
Okay, so I mean, a pro bono legal clinic is just essentially organizations like ours going into the prisons, trying to help as many people as we can who have been awaiting trial or, you know, pretrial detainees who have no access to justice in terms of they don't even have a representation of a lawyer. Many have been in the prisons for many years, have never stepped foot into a court before, have never, you know, had their case listened to, or maybe they've initially had a public defender, but afterwards, because of long delays in the court system, they've, you know, almost been forgotten. So we go in, we try to find people like that. We target people who are of indigent means, so who can't ordinarily afford a lawyer, which is another deterrent to their access to justice. And so we go in and we look for people like that. We'll typically go with our partners, both either from the public sector, so like the public defender or legal aid, or we will go in with private lawyers from our pro bono network and try to get them legal representation or at least some legal advice.
This is becoming a bit like an interview. I've got questions and questions, but I think for our listeners, be interesting to hear your involvement a bit more. So I was thinking, if you're already delivering legal clinics to some of the prisoners, how do you see the informal justice court? Do you see it as the same direction as your existing consultation work, just adding theater, like we discussed before, the crossover between legal and performing arts? How was that? How do you see it?
I think it was I think it was an expansion of the legal clinic structure, not exactly, you know, the same. Of course not, it can't be. But I think it complemented the work well. It was a way to deepen, you know, the knowledge of the inmates, of what they know, and not even just the inmates. I think the different stakeholders involved got to benefit from it in some way. So when I say the different stakeholders, you know, I mean even the lawyers themselves, the prison itself, the justice community at large, so even the Ministry of Justice, because we were able to bring in different elements of that as well to participate. So we had prosecutors from the Ministry of Justice join us during a stage. I don't know if this was already built up. There's a 4-stage project. So we had the legal clinic interview stage. Then the second stage was like a training. And so we had judges, you know, so different components of the criminal justice system came. And I feel it expanded on what a typical legal clinic will be, where we're just interviewing inmates, getting pro bono lawyer, then trying to get them their day in court. This, on the other hand, was almost like a education, right? Training, whereby in the past, the inmates just go to court if they're fortunate enough to get a lawyer. And, you know, whatever the outcome, that's where it ends. In this scenario, we're giving them additional tools. So they're getting education, they're understanding better what's going on in the court system. The other stakeholders that I mentioned are also being brought in to see the challenges a bit more differently than they might typically be aware, because now they are also involved in trying to find the solution. So I think that was also a good component of the legal clinic, where people, I think maybe we can say, can humanize the problem a bit more than just hearing it from their offices or in some reports where it's just stats, just numbers of people. Now you're coming to meet the people who are actually dealing with the problem, and you're helping to find the solution together. So yeah, it was an expansion of the legal clinic. I don't know if that answers the question.
Yeah, I was also thinking of Mile saying that important aspects of your collaboration is how not just its impact on inmates waiting trial, but also how it brings together actors, organizations, different parties that have never met before and never like exchanged with each other on their thoughts on the current situation. Was that your experience? And did you think that was helpful in terms of how did you continue that kind of partnership after the project?
So, I mean, the first question, I think, yes, for sure. There are actors or stakeholders involved that have probably not interacted before. 100%, I would say the theater aspect. I don't think we have Ministry of Justice people, inmates interacting with people from like a theater team or even our pro bono lawyers from law firms. So that is an interesting interaction. Of course, even interacting with Melan Yust from ASTRAP Foundation, you know, so it was all different new elements for people, which I think makes it, you know, interesting, where people, you know, let's be honest, like it's people's day-to-day job. So any element that makes it a bit more interesting to do can excite people to get more involved than just a typical legal clinic. And then what was the second question? Sorry.
Did any of the partnership?
Continuation.
Beyond the project or...
I think a very important aspect of the project was trying to see how we could make it sustainable. And something we tried to do was train some of those who are convicted. So not just those who are in pretrial waiting for a day in court. We wanted to ensure those who are also going to remain in the prison learn as well, so that they can go on, hopefully, to help train other inmates that come in. I think we received some information that that's something that they do and had even been doing already in the past, where people share information on what they know to those who don't have a clue, who are new into the prison. So I think we try to help them, you know, build on that already existing relationship by giving convicts that those tools so they can help us share the information. So I think that's the best sustainable structure that we could come up with, because I don't want to jump ahead into challenges, but like, you know, funding is always a big challenge in any project. It's always limited. So you're always trying to just think of ways that even when the funding stops and actors may not be able to come, you know, as frequently anymore, that there's still a way that at least some element of the project can continue and thrive. And also, very importantly, making sure those who we are trying to help have some sort of ownership of the project, I think is important. So in this case, the main beneficiaries, I would say, are the inmates. Of course, arguably, the community and others benefited in some way. But the inmates being the primary beneficiaries, being able to own it and carry it on themselves, I think was something that we found important to implement.
Mm. Any questions for each other? Have you not talked in the 6 years after the project? Or
no, not at all.
Not at all.
I'm joking. Okay, I'm joking.
Oh, okay.
we were on a panel together, a few panels actually, and they joined me, I think, in Brussels.
In Brussels, yeah.
Okay.
A couple years ago.
Yeah, that's true. There was and we know the build up to the eventual project we're not talking about was quite long. So I guess we knew Funi already, I would say, like 2 years before we started, or even longer maybe, because we got to know her. I remember, okay, we met a lot of people in this project, but I remember the time we met Funi for the first time very clearly. Not only because later on she turned out to be essential in her organization in doing this project, and not only implementing, but also in developing the idea, opening doors. But I remember that night well, because I got the sense that Funi got the idea that we wanted to bring across. And because it's a bit of a layered project in some regards, and the things that we'll talk about, that I remember that she got it as we were thinking about it right away. Right, others, it took some time, but she got it right away. And I think, for us, after that, it still took some time, I guess, before really knew how to form an alliance to do this together. Mm-hmm. Because I guess if you work together, you have to find a common goal, or you have different goals that they can be aligned. So, you know, for her organization, I guess, it had a certain function, for example, a new way of doing something you already did, of generate also attention by doing a new way of working. And for us, it had also a different meaning, and also for the other partners. So I think what we did, we aligned them nicely, and that worked out well.
Any stories of disagreement or, I don't know, like, we want some stories now because we've been quite abstract.
Well, then we have to go to Melle, you know.
Okay.
Well, I didn't prep any, but let's say I think there are numerous of moments that we try to be proactive, helping the project forward. And then... we did things, and then finally, you know, Funi called us like, oh my God, guys, what did you do now again? And then we were always very naive in thinking, oh, but we thought, let's say, you know, we can talk to prison officials ourselves, and then we would just call somebody and ask for a meeting, go there, and then had a really nice conversation. And then, we screwed up the whole, let's say, build up a strategy which we completely were not aware of how things work in the network. So, I remember this one time we went to the prison. I think I told that in the first podcast, did I?
Yeah, you mentioned that. I don't think you went in much detail, but you did mention that sometimes.
Okay, well, I don't know.
Try to go yourself.
If you remember that, we once went to the, I think, EOE prison, and then we talked to the director to say hello, and we were, you know, sort of wondering how things were going and if we could proceed. And then I think a day later, you called us like, guys, what did you do? You know, you you talked to this guy and now he wants more. And that was a sort of, well, for us also a little insight of, this networking thing works very differently than we are used to. So let's open up the discussion. Doesn't necessarily mean you get things done. It's also a sort of, be very precise on who you talk to and why and in what moment. So that was one of these moments that, well, we at least found out that we didn't understand the game at all.
Do you understand it now? After.
Well, no, I don't think so, because it's, let's say, if we saw Voomni work, of course, and then the level of understanding all these different networks and how they are interacting with each other, and you know who is sort of in charge with what and with who, and so that is all very complex to understand, because if the name tag says, you know, this is the deputy of this or that, doesn't necessarily mean he doesn't have influence on other parts. And to understand that, how people are actually using their influence and where they're active in, that you can only understand if you are really engaged with the network. And so for us, we could never get to that level at all. So it was also,
it's an informal system on its own.
Yeah. And then how that works is something, well, of course, now we understand a bit, you know, let's say how the dynamics work, but then to operate it, that's a different thing.
Mm. Yeah. For me, how did you feel about, can you tell us a little bit about the difficulty of gaining access or gaining interest in collaboration, whatever you could share, because doing prison theater in China was also incredibly difficult. So I'm interested to hear if there's similar challenges.
Yes, I mean, I think Mel has given a really good background. In fact, honestly, as you said, it's been quite a few years now that I don't remember a lot. So I'm finding it interesting that he actually is able to remember a few specifics, which is helpful for me to jog my memory. But I think just as you alluded to, Zhao, is like you're dealing with politics. That's the truth. You know, there's no other way to put it. And I think politics anywhere in the world is always going to be a bit of a dance. You know, what you see is not necessarily what's going on. You know, there's a lot of smiling, a lot of, you know, friendliness, but it's always different behind the scenes. And that's, you know, essentially, you know, unfortunately, what we had to deal with. So I know Mel and Yust, I think I said at the beginning, it's something they had already been trying to implement for a while, spoken to so many people. And I think they would agree with me. They had already experienced what I'm saying. You know, people say, oh, great, sure, yes. A year passes, no one's doing anything. 2 years pass, you know, it's just how everyone says, yes, we can help, we can do this, but nothing moves. And so when we were finally able to get things to move, it was because we were trying to pass it through a very narrow relationship, or let's say pipeline, that we already had as an organization, which, as I explained, is our pro bono legal clinics, and then build on that and say, okay, we already do this at the prisons. Now we want to see if we can, you know, expand it a bit, try something new for the inmates to learn a bit differently. We didn't want to go in as, oh, hey, guys, we have this exciting new thing we want to bring to the prison, because, yeah, that's really going to fly. A whole bureaucratic process will have to start, trigger another how many years of needing approvals for that. Someone might even tell you, we need to change the entire law to do something like that. You know, you don't want to reach the level where it sounds so grand. And of course, you know, I love working with my international partners, but there is also sometimes challenges with that when people feel like, oh, you're bringing foreigners to see the underbelly, because the prison is where the countries and politicians hide, unfortunately, a lot of things that they may not want the public to see. So there's also that element, and you're trying to be, you know, explaining to Melang, you're just like, okay, you know, I know you want to be friendly and you want to meet people and laugh with people, but once they see an international component, it also changes the dynamic. There's when Mel says they're expecting more, you know, I'm sure he means more information. I won't say more than that. But like they see that and they're like, oh, this could be profitable in some way, maybe. I don't know. I wouldn't say too much. But, you know, so you're just trying to handle. So it made it a bit, I would say, definitely a bit stressful handling so many different elements and dynamics and everyone's different expectations. And from the Nigerian politics side, trying to, you know, not also, to be fair on them, not make them feel this is going to be some expose and, you know, they turn around tomorrow and there's some scary documentary that has gone online about how horrible things are, you know, and you're trying to make them trust us, you know, prison officials and all of that. No, we're truly just trying to help. Melanie's, of course, are trying to get some documentation in visual art form. They want to get recording or camera, you know, pictures. I'm like, oh, God, you know, how do we make that happen without it looking like we're trying to sneak things? So there was a lot of that, you know, okay, you have to take pictures, but no one's face can show for the confidentiality of the inmates themselves, right? We have to also remember we're protecting their privacy, too. They're confident. So there were all these different areas of tension that you just have to keep like working with to make happen. But we somehow made it happen. And let's not forget, very importantly, this also, by the time we were able to green light it and start, was also the pandemic. So just to make it even more exciting and make the stakes even higher, we were dealing with a time where there was limited access, limited movement. People weren't even allowed into the prison. I remember some of my partners asking me, how, this is a miracle, you're a miracle worker. Like, how did you get us access into the prison? Because they're not allowing any NGOs in right now. And not only did you get us access, you're even bringing an international command. I'm like, I don't know. You can't ask me that. But somehow we were able to make it work.
And maybe to add, which makes it even more credible, around that time, or before actually the project had to be postponed, there were big riots in Lagos, protests against a brutal police unit that we later in the project encountered in many stories of the inmates. But there were big protests that was slammed down. But then I guess widespread violence broke out in Lagos, affecting also, for example, the courthouses that were to do research that they were plundered and set the light. And the same was also happening in several prisons in Nigeria, including Ikoyim. And so they burned, there was a riot and they burned down the administration office and some other parts. So there was also, quite a bit of unrest in the prison, which also, I guess, could mean for our project that it had to be postponed or canceled. So, but even given that, on top of the corona, it made it very special.
I hear, just thinking lots of comparisons, definitely from my experience of trying to do theater stuff in Chinese prison, for example, some trusted partners that they have worked with, acting as your guarantor is super, super important. And also, what can you offer me is definitely something they asked. It has to be mutually beneficial. For example, in the UK, the His Majesty's prison system do have a formal research request process where you can go through and to ask for research access or conduct activities or maybe rehab, rehabilitation projects. But in places like China, maybe Nigeria as well, and other places, it's about mutual benefits. It can be a healthy benefit, of course, but just to say that I'm interested in research or doing a project is not enough. you need to, and there's a tension between them really wanting external attention and input. So Chinese prison management recognize that there is a lot of ideas about rehabilitation or creative methods. For example, meditation is hugely popular in Chinese prisons. It aligns with like Chinese tradition. It has a set of a program that they can follow, and they can create meditation rooms that looks nice for the pictures. They are open to it, and because prisons is hard to access for artists or for researchers, most people don't really try. So I was a lecturer in China, and all my colleagues worked in criminal justice research, and none of them are going into prison because they don't want the cost of uncertainty, time, waiting, and you have to really be patient. I've had a project where I spent 5 months back and forth, gaining trust, explaining what it is, getting permission. And 2 weeks before, they cancel it because some superior came to visit and they mentioned, and they saw that project on the desk and they were like, I'm not sure if that's a good idea. And that's all they take to be for it to be canceled. So they crave external help as well and attention, and they're quite isolated in their work. When I was working with prisoners, often we do a lot of drama games and exercises, and the officers who are watching us would join in because they're eager to have some like new input because they're so bored in their job too. But they are extremely concerned for security and risk. Reputational, especially another risk, all the things that you've mentioned as well. So they are very conflicted. They welcome us, but they're also really worried. And we also had once a group fight during our theater program, and we couldn't access for like 2 months because it was closed off because of that. But accessing during COVID is incredible. That's definitely not possible. Since COVID, I've only been to Chinese prison once. I actually had to change my research career because of COVID, because there's just no access anymore to the field site. Maybe Fumi, another question about the project. Is there any really memorable person or stories during the informal justice court that you remember?
I think there were several. I'm trying to see if there's any one I would highlight. I certainly enjoyed. So unfortunately, we weren't able to do what Yustam Mel had visualized, or you know what the dream was for the fourth stage, which was going to be the inmates acting the drama themselves after being trained, and then using that as a way to showcase to a wider audience, you know, what's been going on, the challenges and everything, hear their voices and their side of the story and humanize them. So we ended up having to use the theater team themselves to act out the case, to act out the story that had been created. And so I think I must say I genuinely enjoyed when the play was shown during our pro bono week events, which we hosted with Mel and Yust a final night at the Alliance Française, a really nice theater. And there we had like government officials, judges, people from, you know, aspects of the legal community that can actually make a difference. I remember there was even a very senior ranking legislator who joined. We had the deputy chief of staff to the president there, like real big people, because he's on our board. He's a former attorney general of Lagos State. So he brought a big legislator with him to the event. And I must say, when the play was going on, for me, that was where everything came together finally, because it was a way to show people, almost like criticize, but with humor, you know, because we're showing the judges and the government and the people, like, these are the ways that the system is broken, and they're watching it. And I think it's something I've read in the past that I always like to use when I talk about the project, like, theater is a way to tell people when they're doing wrong, or criticize people, critique people without their defenses going up immediately. So because they don't immediately feel like you're attacking them, or they think they're just watching a story, and eventually they might see themselves in the story and maybe hopefully realize, okay, maybe I could be doing something different, you know, and it doesn't feel too aggressive. And so I think that I enjoyed, because, you know, of course, the work in the prison itself was great. I know that there was this amazing guy who used to play his guitar, and Mela used to cut that, and there was just all these lovely elements. But for me, I really liked that final moment where judges were in the audience and they were laughing at themselves, you know, because they're watching a play where someone is lamenting, like, oh, you know, finally it's my day in courts, I'm finally going to be free or something. And then he gets there and then the judge like coughs. And then the registrar says, oh, court is no longer in session. The judge is sick, is indisposed. And then they're like, your cases are drawn for another like 5 years. And it's made in a comic way for people to like laugh or whatever. And the guy is like, and I think Mela used to identify in Nigeria, the acting sometimes can be very dramatic. It's not as subtle. Well, for us, it works in our context, you know. So the guy's like, oh, like moaning and, oh, you know, it's almost like a pantomime kind of. But it was interesting. That's why I would say I really enjoyed, because they were laughing at themselves. And I liked that. Like, you don't really see that with Nigerian politicians, but they got it. They laughed, and hopefully maybe it passed on, you know, because a key aspect of the work we were doing, maybe not just to have inmates get released, which is great, but was to create that information, give that information out there, let people see what's going on. And if that was one of our outcomes, I think in that moment we succeeded at that outcome of spreading the story in a wider, you know, audience and humanizing it.
Mm. I don't think we heard about that performance in the last episode. Maybe Mila can tell us a little bit more about it. Like, who wrote it? Is it scripted?
No, it's great to hear from me, because because for us that was also an exciting idea, that such a high officials also would really, you know, take notice of this project. I mean, that's a big honor if you can get that far doing a pilot program. So that was already great. But for us, it was also hard to understand, how far can you take it, and how much risk do you actually take by putting a theater maker inside a conference where all the politicians are, you know, talking about their policy and all the important work they do, and then suddenly put a theater performance inside. I mean, us it seems actually normal, but I guess also for Fumi it was also a big risk in a way to do this. So for us that was not per se clear from the beginning how this would be. So it's great to hear back that it also worked out, because I think it did, because the people were really laughing during the play, and after the play there was also a panel discussion, and people would refer a lot of times back to the scenes of the play, which I guess is a good sign that people relate to it. So it's good to hear that somehow this was a way to be critical and at the same time inspire and be not too much provocative.
How was the play produced? Because I don't think you shared that in the last episode.
Yeah, well, as also Fumihino just mentioned, because indeed we did not really mention it, the idea was in essence that also the play would be designed and performed by the inmates for the inmates. So there was also the idea that once you have a small group, you teach them the skills of the informal justice court, then the play will be a way to also teach the other 3,000 inmates who cannot take part. So that initial idea was in that way, you know, a way how can we synthesize the bigger group? And because that was also considered, also because of the COVID, but also to consider it as a risk. Hey, you don't put 3,000 people on the field and do a play. I mean, that can go, well, you know, the it's just a safety issue as well. So that also made us improvise, like, okay, then we anyway do this play. And then Tunji took his team together to sort of cherry pick from the performances and then mix it with also more traditional storylines of the theater known plays of the, let's say, the older plays of the historical plays. And then merge that into a theater program. And that was performed on that night, but later on we also performed it in Prison Park, or I call it. That was Freedom Park. That was also more a public performance. Mm. But that was more for general public. And then for us, yeah, this may be also a question to you, Fumi, that we were really a bit in the air of could then a performance like this fly as a public performance, which you could sort of, you know, do in more venues, and it never happened after that. So we were always a bit like weary, like, okay, what why is this, why doesn't that take off?
Well, I certainly think it's something that would fly. I mean, this is not my field, of course. I'm very far from theatre. I'm glad you guys brought me into it. But I can see that being a play that would resonate for sure with people. The whys, I'm sorry to sound simplistic if I do, but I feel it always boils down to funding. Yeah. I think if there's someone bankrolling something that's interested in it and wants to support it and, you know, put it on the road, you know, I'm sure it would definitely go. So I think it has to be a matter of having someone who has, will I say, the interest and the willpower that wants to support it going. So maybe someone with a grant or just an independent person that wants to support the theatre team doing it. But certainly theatre is a big part of Nigerian culture.
Yeah. You know,
a lot of theatre plays that go on at different arenas that people go to watch. So I certainly can see this. As I said, it's not my area, so I just don't know what I'm assuming that it would be. You may know more than me, actually, that to have a play become successful and go around probably needs some sort of financial support or something. I don't know.
Yeah. Mm. No, Fukte, I remember that Tunji of at the last moment changed the title. So I think first the title was Stolen Time, and then you know, when it became a public play, he changed, I think, in the last moment, the name of the play from Stolen Time to Adjourned. What was it?
Objection Sustained.
Yeah.
Objection Sustained.
So that was also for us a sign like, whoa, you know, this is maybe also, let's say, it's getting maybe too much political, or because it's out in the open then. It was a public performance in a public space. But yeah, for us it was always, we never really knew how, if that is a risky thing to do or not, or but that was for us also an interesting moment of what's happening here.
I must say, just if I may, that Lagos is not a representation of Nigeria. Lagos is, like, you know, the city, the metropolis, like there's a lot more that can go on in Lagos freely and stuff that may not be able to go on in more remote parts of the country. There are other parts of the country that I don't even go with the type of law that Lagos has. There are northern parts that go with the Muslim law, the Sharia law. You know, there's different, you know, differences in different parts of the country. And Lagos is definitely way more liberal. So I just want to say that I don't think there will be as much pushback, even in terms of why he changed the name from Stolen Time. I don't know, but Lagos, they can be quite relaxed about things like that. It's not, you know, no one is unlikely to get like arrested or anything like that over something like that. It's not taken that typically that seriously, unless you're maybe directly naming someone, a politician, or directly. But as long as it's done in the manner it is, it's fine. But I just wanted to, because I think, yeah, you where these risks you're talking about, for sure, other parts of Nigeria, I think you would definitely be more cautious in what you're trying to do.
Mm, I think that's true probably for a lot of bigger countries where there's a huge discrepancy geographically. Like in the States, different states will be really different. In China, like rural China, urban China are hugely different. My first project when I was doing my MA dissertation was in, let's say, one of the biggest cities in China. And they have been collaborating with local universities for like 10 years. So they're really used to it. They're like, okay, yeah. The only thing is they're always collaborating with a psychology department. So they cannot understand what applied theater is. They keep calling me psychology professor. And then I just decided to roll with it. but other than that, yeah, there is a big difference from big cities and their reception to things. One last thing from me, maybe, listeners will have to stay tuned for the next episode because this question might be better answered by Tunji. But just interested from your observation and living in Lagos, Fumi, do you think there's an existing theatre scene already in Nigerian prisons? Like you said, theatre is a big part of Nigerian cultural life. So are there existing performances in prisons when you go visit or from your understanding?
I believe so. I don't know. Actually, Melayus might be better suited, surprisingly, to answer this. But I think in the research, we found that they were already putting on plays. And I know the prisons have like different, not just hobbies, but like pathways or vocations, recreational activities, I should say, for inmates to do. And I believe there is a theater department already. I don't know if there's, I know they have like people who make like Walkman tools, like carpentry, things like that, religious activities. So I don't know, guys, was there existing a theater team? I feel like there
is. Yeah, it was. I think there was at least one NGO working there that we knew of from we talked to. And so some of the inmates that participated in our project also had T-shirts of that NGO. So, and that's because we also wanted to invite inmates who had an interest in theater. So that's why they joined, I guess, to be part of that. And but I also encountered it when I did some online research on videos about Ikui Prison. It's a prison, but still there are quite a few videos you can find on the internet showing different things, you know, officials going in or stuff, but also performances of theater that they do. It's difficult to understand exactly what's going on or when it was taped and everything, but they have been doing that for quite a while, I guess. But then again, you know better than us, I think, the large tradition that exists in prisons to engage in theater, I think, around the world. I think it's... in the research that we did for the project, we found many, 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 many examples of the role of theater in prisons, right? And, yeah, many different ways.
Yeah, but it sounds like, at least in your experience, there were no like large scale institutional level of production, right? They're like interest groups or NGO projects. Yeah, okay. In my experience in China, after a long time, realized that they have a very established existing institutional level of organizing performance in Chinese prisons. And what they did with us is that they said yes to our proposals, but actually they want to absorb us into what they have. So over time, by not really giving us support, this episode, I don't think is going to go on the Chinese platform, by the way. But I'm writing a book about it, so it's going to come out. Anyway, so the idea is that they say yes to our proposal first, and then there's a lack of support, so we don't actually get to do what we do. And then slowly they invite us to supervise their performance that they want. So in the end, we become a technical support to their existing programs. And that's basically what happened over a few years.
I was thinking about one more angle the theater played out in the project is that we use theater also as a way of educating or transferring information, you know, in a different way, in a more engaged way, in a more theoretical way. But that also fits maybe Nigerian tradition in theater play or culturally, but also legally, in the sense that they have, for example, in Nigeria, a different law system or a court system that's different from the Netherlands. In the Netherlands, if you go to a courtroom, you see the law, you see the same people, but all is done on paper. You know, they don't have witnesses. On very rare occasions that a judge, there's like a dispute about a witness, then they can call in a witness. But normally there are no witnesses. There's no other, just paperwork and talks of the prosecutor and the defense lawyer. Maybe the suspect is there, but not even that. So, and maybe there are like three people in the room, you know. So law many times not really a very public thing. It's very not accessible. But in Nigeria, they have, I forgot the name, but the system you also see in the United States, Fumigant knows more about this, but we have to present the evidence in front of the judge at that time. So if a witness is not there, he cannot bear witness, you know, and in the Netherlands it's way different. But what I mean, you need like performative art in some way to convince a jury, for example, or a judge. Yeah, it's not only the content of what you say, but also the way how you say it and how you ask questions or how you can answer a judge in a way that helps your case instead of hurting it.
Mm. Yeah, that's contextually different. I think the Chinese court system is a lot less performative. We don't have a jury system, and the judge has overwhelming power. So there's a very limited thing what a prosecutor, like lawyers or barrister, can do in a courtroom. So less theatrical prep will be needed. So yeah, well, all very interesting legal, social, political, criminal justice and artistic differences between three or even more context that we talked about today. I think that's it for me in terms of questions. But do you have anything to add? Do you want to say?
I just wanted to add, Nigeria doesn't have a jury system, but I understand what Yust was saying, that yes, there is more room for lawyer to make a presentation to the judge and all that. Yes, so I just want to make sure.
Yeah, thank you for me. I didn't
make it sound like we have a jury system.
Yeah, no, sorry. That I was just
yeah,
pointing out that you have to present your case.
Yeah, more like you move a motion. You have to. Yes, of course. Yeah. I agree.
Yeah. I was surprised. I was surprised. I didn't fully appreciate it beginning how much a difference that can make also. I mean, when you think about it, of course, but it's you can do it excellently, you can do it good, but it's more that you can make mistakes. It's more about maybe preventing mistakes than adding an extra layer of drama. But to understand, if you say it like this in a certain way, it just looks wrong. you know, you're probably not. So it's even on that level also, I think.
No, I agree. Your work is also partly to convince the judge, right?
Yeah.
Of what you're saying. It's not just purely on the law, and hopefully that is what should make should convince and should be what the case is judged on. But of course, you're right. There's the flair. There are lawyers who are known for being, you know, really great orators. Even in the country, there are famous lawyers who know how to, you know, make a case. It's just like any debate. If you have someone who's good at presenting it, even the person who has good, strong points, if he doesn't say it well, as you said, like, yes, that might hurt the case. Or if you're nervous, right? It's not even, you may forget to make some points. You might not bring out everything you intended to say compared to someone who's, you know, really prepared.
Yeah, definitely. I think in China, it might be the opposite. I've heard that lawyers who are very flamboyant actually very much disliked by judges. And some clients like them, but it seems like you could have an informal court system, informal court, justice court for lawyers too, to perfect their skills.
Yeah, you do have those, like mock trials. Even at the Ministry of Justice, they do things like to prepare for a case, right? Yes, for sure.
Mm. Mm.
So, Fungi, maybe as a last question, that you think from all the experiments we did, were there some elements you thought, oh, that is actually something we can integrate into our normal program? Maybe not the whole shebang, but just elements of it?
I mean, I think so. It's I hope to not sound like a spoiled record, but certainly, like, there are things that work, you know, and are great for teaching. But I think to go back to what I said earlier about the most sustainable form was, I think, what we tried to do, let the inmates continue. And I think something I think we had an idea about was finding ways to also maybe use technology. I don't know if you recall, I think like adding digital elements these days is always the best way as well to help it scale faster. So if I know we were hoping maybe we could create some videos, some tutorials, you know, if there are things that require less human resource, right? Because that's always the big issue. It's the strain on human resources, you know, the work that PIOP currently does already, you know, we're already like significantly understaffed to do, you know, and I can boldly say that I don't even mind this being shown in Nigeria, in my case, support us. So we're already significantly understaffed to help the number of people. We're trying to use a digital platform that we've been developing to help with that. And that way it makes it easier to match those who need services. Because at the core of what we do really is matching people who need lawyers with those who can provide the lawyers. So anything else outside of that, it's, you know, even that we struggle to meet the demand, right? So to then try to take on anything new or try to do, you know, some new project, you know, because that's one way that we get support is by doing special projects. And so those special projects, the funding is typically, as we know, for a period of time. And once that's done, we're not able to continue it. So that's why the aim is always to just find ways that, as part of the project, how do we ensure, like, when this is done, it can continue without us? If we don't get, if we get funding to say we want to take this to another prison or another part of the country, of course, we would happily do that, right? But yes, I think that's the main way I would say is if technology could be used to create, for me, I would think that was always my dream. I think I said it on a few meetings we used to have planned, would be to create some sort of tutorial videos. Mm-hmm. Where if this could become a course in the prisons, I think would be great. And the course is just run by inmates getting to watch maybe a 4-part, 6-part video and answer some questions after each video to show the knowledge they've gained. And after that, when they complete the course, they even get a certificate to show that they underwent this training. Like that, I think, would be something that would be a great, amazing way to make it sustainable and even fully integrate it into the prison structure. And I don't see why there should be much pushback, at least in Lagos anyways, for something like that, because, you know, it's an easy win for a government administration to also say they've helped increase access to justice, because giving inmates more information, that's helping them access justice a bit, right? So that would be the best way I would say. So some sort of digitization of it.
But would you think that's a betrayal of theater, Milay, because theater is presence? Would you be like, how do you think about that?
Well, let's say we were impressed with also the skills we just found in the group of inmates. Yeah? There were great performances inside this group, and some even, you know, stepped up of, you know, acting out a prosecutor role, and they did a great job from the beginning. And so there was a lot of talent, and I think also a lot of expertise in performance, and in so in that case I was stunned with the fact that you could just spark it and things got on a roll. But indeed, you cannot ignore the part of, you know, theater is also practice. Eh? You have to act to learn acting, and to coach that, and to build up also a level of trust within a group. That is something you cannot digitize for sure. And that's something you have to create in the moment, and you have to also have a continuation, because we also managed, I think, after a couple of 4 or 5 times, that that the level of trust was growing big enough to make the program work. So that is something you need for sure. But I agree with Fumni that if you know, the content is there, so if you could sort of put that on video, then and you have, instead of 6 coaches, only 1 coach going to prison, that would already, you know, make it a lot more easy to fund. Mm.
Yeah. The other party.
No, I was just going to say, I must say, I think I answered the question from a law perspective. I just want to clarify. I don't think I was answering it from a theater perspective. So that's why when I'm answering your question, to be honest, I'm thinking of the training aspect of the 4 parts projects. So obviously we have the legal clinic was the first aspect, where we had an interview stage to select who goes on. And then the training, where we brought in the prosecutors, the judges, the lawyers. Then the third stage was this mock trial where they're acting, right? And then the fourth stage was the theater play. So I think I was answering based on, if I'm being honest, the second stage, which is getting the inmates more knowledge about the law, how the court system works, the different aspects of it. I guess that's where I'm thinking of, oh, that would be great to do in digital format. I honestly cannot answer about theater, so because I don't know anything about that. Maybe Dr. Aziz will be the best person for Mel's question. If the question is, can elements of the theater continue in the prison? I think the theater team will have to answer that. So I'm thinking, can elements of the training and giving information and stuff like that continue? I think a digital format will be a good way to do that. There was something Mel said that also made me think of what an idea he, I think, had when we were doing this, that I also thought, you know, wouldn't this be great as well, was creating, I think, a board game.
Mm-hmm.
Do I remember correctly?
Yeah.
And he had designed this amazing Monopoly-style board game that was aimed at teaching the inmates about their rights through this play, gameplay. And I also think that would be brilliant if that was something that could have really, you know, that could get commissioned. I don't know why, what would stop it, but if that's something that's done, happily we could introduce that, because, again, that takes limited time, you know, just one showcase event, launch the board game, have, again, everything, I think, digital is the most sustainable if we're being pragmatic and realistic. Have another video that explains how the board game is played. But then at least the inmates can then, which is what I think maybe, I don't know, a little bit more theater aspect, they then at least play the board game together perhaps they can then be acting while playing the game, if that's part of the game. I don't know. But that's just the thoughts I'm having.
There is a game in the UK, I don't know if Mila is aware, Probationary. It's a monopoly on probation process.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I played it like 10 years ago. It's developed by Liverpool John Moore University's criminology team. And I emailed them last year about it. And they said, sadly, there's no funding. I think that's why it didn't really get produced. So they came up with this great game. And now we can't use it anywhere, like not even in the UK, because there's just not existing anymore. Like,
Wouldn't that just be great if there was just endless funding for all the great ideas that everybody has ever had?
I know. We have so many good ideas. We really should be funded.
Yes.
I kind of lost my thought.
You wanted to say something, no?
Yeah, any last comments? I think the time's running out, but if I remember what I was going to say, I will say it. But before that... do you have anything to add, anyone?
I think this was, for me personally, a very nice session to take part in. I really enjoyed hearing Fumni's perspective and ideas and recollections again. And I cannot stress enough again how important she and her organization were in the whole project. So we're really grateful. And like you said, I mean, if we would probably continue this podcast and we make up another 100 nice ideas we can get funding for. So it's always nice and inspiring to talk to you. So thanks.
Thank you. And I just remembered what I was going to say, so I'm just going to have a last word. I was remembering that officers, we might not have time to go into this today because time is limited, but in our projects, officers, especially young officers, are an important part too. We've had officers coming to us saying that it's their dream to become an actor instead of a prison officer. So they really jumped on our project and really helped us. And we had an officer who wanted to produce 12 Angry Men in the prison we went in. And the leadership at the time said, definitely not. But last year it got produced after like 8 years because of a change of leadership. So, and that change was totally pushed by the officer, after we've left. So training them, those who are interested, and they staying long on their job. So they're quite constant, in the prison environment, and they are inside as well. And if they have a love for, the arts, they are a great asset to continue things without funding because they're already paid. So yeah, that's my last word. Thank you so much for everyone for joining us today. And thank you for listening to our episode. Clearly we have more to talk about. Hopefully we will have Tongji with us next time, so maybe you can hear more about the theater production and theater company side of things. So thank you and goodbye, everyone.
You have been listening to the INCJ podcast, conversations about international criminal justice. To find out more, go to our website at criminaljusticenetwork.net. or follow us on Twitter at INTCJ Network.